most of us have
not explored the Pythagorean theorem in quite a while, and there's certainly no shame in that. It was invented by a Greek mathematician and philosopher named Pythagoras, and it's real simple. You learned it in school, most of us, but we've probably forgotten it. If you have a right triangle, and you have the two sides, A and B, and then the hypotenuse, C, the long side, then the Pythagorean theorem says that A squared plus B squared equals C squared. Now, don't worry, we are going to get into some Bible here. This is not a geometry lesson, but it's going to help us understand something about implication. Something that is implicit means that it hasn't been stated for you yet, but it is in the information that you have. Explicit means it's stated straight up and you can read it right there on the page. Implicit means it's on the page, but it's inside of the information. You've got to get it out. And so the Pythagorean theorem is going to help us get that implicit and explicit explanation understood. Because if you have a right triangle and one side is 3 and the bottom side is 4, then what is the hypotenuse? 3 squared. What is the hypotenuse? 5. But that's not written on the page. But you know it just as if it were. It's implied. Something that is not explicitly stated, but is there for you just as sure as if it were explicitly stated. Now, give you a Bible example of that. If you go to the book of Revelation, you're going to read that the gates of the city, talking about heaven, the gates of the city are always open by day, and there is no night there. Okay, what's implied by the statement that the gates of the city are always opened by day and there is no night? What's the implication? They're always open. There is never a time when they're not open because it's always day. Now, it doesn't state that they're always open. It states they're always open by day and there's no night. But the implication is the thing not stated but just as true as if it were, it's never closed. Now, what we're going to see this evening is there are some very real implications to the belief in God and to the non-belief in God that sometimes, even though people don't state them, they are there in the information and they're just as true and just as sometimes what we're going to see dangerous as if they were clearly stated by the people who hold those beliefs. Let me lead then into our lesson. In the mid-1800s, actually it was about the late 1880s, there was a guy by the name of George Walser. And George Walser decided he was going to found a township. He called it Liberal Missouri. We wouldn't really necessarily call it a city. It was originally smaller, but the charter for the town was simply this. You could not believe in God and be a charter member of this particular township. You could not believe in heaven. You could not believe in hell. You could not believe in anything spiritual. You had to be a materialist, meaning you had to think that this material world is all that there is, all that there was, all that there ever will be. The idea of atheism was the founding idea for Liberal Missouri. Now, I have been out to Liberal Missouri. Here are some pictures from Liberal Missouri. Right now, there's a population of 779, at least there was about 10 years ago. If you look at the sign street names, you see Walser, named for George Walser, who founded the city back in 1880. You see Darwin Drive, named after Charles Darwin because of his atheism and his theory there of evolution. You see Ingersoll Drive, or Ingersoll Road, named for Robert Ingersoll, the agnostic who was so very famous and who, I believe, wrote an article or an essay, something about why I'm not a Christian, things along those lines. Okay, so he founds this town, Liberal, based on the idea that there is no God, and here's what he says is going to happen. He says, people who don't believe in a God can stop wasting their time on spiritual pursuits. And they can concentrate their time on stuff that really matters. Building houses, making society a better place. So he said, what's going to happen when we get a bunch of people in here together that don't believe in God? Then this society is going to be the best that humans have ever seen in the world. We're going to be the guinea pigs for what would happen if we had a bunch of people who didn't waste their time on religion and concentrated on this world. Social experiment. How do you think it went? Well, I think most of us know exactly how that would go, but let's let history tell us how it went. There's a man by the name of Clark Braden. Clark Braden was a member of the Lord's Church, if I understand it right. He was a traveling preacher and debater, and he went to Liberal, Missouri to see what was going on. So he goes to Liberal, Missouri, and he finds out that the place is a moral cesspool. Says everything there is terrible, and he writes an article for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in 1885 about Liberal, Missouri. I think I've got a copy of that. Yeah, we called the county seat there. They had the newspaper on file and sent us a copy of the actual article. And in the article, here's what he says. He said, everybody cusses, including all of the children. He said, drunkenness is rampant. It's all throughout the streets. He said, all the hotels have turned into brothels, and the place is terrible. You would never want to live there. But the people who are there cannot get out because the property value has sunk so low that they cannot even sell their homes. Well, one of the hotel owners was so angry at the accusation that his hotel had become a brothel that he sued Clark Braden for $25,000. And in 1885, $25,000 was a considerable amount of money. But apparently the evidence was so very available and easy to see that the case was thrown out of court. Clark Braden never had to appear, and the person who sued him had to pay all of the court costs. Now, what are we trying to say with this social experiment? Well, what we're seeing here is the idea that if you were to found a town, a life, a group of people getting together, a society, on the idea that there's no God, it's going to fail. Now, the psalmist told us this in Psalm 14, 1, 2, and 3. He said, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Now, most of us stop right there. But if you continue reading, you see the commentary on what happens when you put that atheistic idea into practice. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable things. There is none who does good, no, not one. And so that's the commentary on the concept of the fool saying in his heart, there is no God. What happens when you put that into practice? They are corrupt. They've done abominable things. There is none who does good, no, not one. And so what I'm telling you this evening is that the implication of godlessness leads to an immoral, unproductive, ruined life. And what I'm telling you is that the implication of Christianity, if put into practice, leads to a happy, joyous, peaceful, productive life on this earth and then eternal life after that. And so let's continue with this. Let me tell you what happened to George Walser, by the way. Founds this city. If you go to it, very interesting. In fact, one of the most unique burial situations I've ever seen. All of the people who died in Liberal, Missouri are buried in a circle. Almost like this auditorium. If you were to take this auditorium all the way around, it was about this size too. And right in the middle, it would be about right here, there was a place for George Walser to be buried. Well, George Walser is not buried in Liberal, Missouri. He's buried in Lamar, Missouri, about 45 minutes away, because later he came in contact with the teachings of Jesus Christ and realized, oh, that was a terrible idea. He became a philanthropist and changed his entire life and said, I don't want to be buried in Liberal, Missouri. I'm going to be buried somewhere else, not with all of those unbelievers. I want to be buried somewhere where I'm not surrounded by the dead bodies of unbelievers. And so he was buried in Lamar, Missouri, and completely changed his life years after founding Liberal. Now, what you'd like to think is that George Walser tried this social experiment and realized, oh, hey, this doesn't work. I've got to find something else. and then did find the teachings of Jesus, and that is why he changed. That's what you'd like to think. Now, before we go into this idea, I'm going to ask the simple question. What would the fruits of Christianity be? I mean, let's say you believe in a man named Jesus who is God in the flesh, came down, died for your sins, and you put into practice his teachings. What would happen if everybody did that? Well, now this guy, his name is Bertrand Russell, and he's writing about Christianity. Now, he's not a friend of Christianity at all. He doesn't like Christianity. He doesn't think you should be a Christian, why he's not a Christian, etc. Here's what he says, though, happens when Christianity takes over. He says, Christianity, as soon as it conquered the state, put an end to the gladiatorial shows, not because they were cruel, but because they were idolatrous. The result, however, was to diminish the widespread education and cruelty by which the populace of Roman towns were degraded. Christianity also did much to soften the lot of slaves. It established charity on a large scale, inaugurated hospitals. Although the great majority of Christians failed lamentably in Christian charity, the ideal remained alive, and in every age inspired some notable saints. In a new form, it passed over modern liberalism and remains the inspiration behind much that is most hopeful in our somber world. All right, Mr. Russell, do you believe you should be a Christian? No, I don't believe you should be a Christian. Okay, what happens when people act like Christians? Well, softens a lot of slaves, they inaugurate hospitals, they cut out gladiatorial shows, and they diminish the widespread education in cruelty, and Christianity remains the inspiration behind much that is most hopeful in our somber world. Now, let's just ask the simple question. What if you acted like a Christian all the time? What if you did to others what you wanted them to do to you? Would you want to live in a society where people did that? Would you want to live in a society where, according to Philippians chapter 2, verses 3 and following, the mind of Christ is this: let each one look out not only for his own interest, but also for the interest of others. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Would you like to live in a society like that? Would you like to live in a society where people are tender-hearted, kind, forgiving, bearing one another's burdens? Would you like to live in a society where there is generosity that abounds, and one of the reasons that a person works with his hands or her hands so he or she can have something to give to those who have need? If you were to put into practice Christianity every day, would you like to live in a society where everybody does that? Sure you would. Would you like to live in a family where all the members of the family are doing that? Absolutely, positively. Now, we need to stop here and understand something. Lots of times, the skeptical community is going to say of Christianity, well, hold on just a second. Christianity is responsible for the Crusades. I mean, is that what you're saying is a product of Christianity, the Crusades, where in about 1000 AD, people in England sent the Catholic Church sent thousands and thousands of Christians to kill the Muslims and retake the Holy Land? Is that Christianity? Now, here's what you need to understand. Putting Christianity into practice is something very different than saying you're a Christian. You understand what I mean by that? Are there some people right now who say they're a Christian, but they cuss on a regular basis? Are there some people right now who say they are Christians, but they steal from their work environments? Are there some people right now who say that they are Christians, but they are committing sexual immorality? Are there some? Okay, you see what I'm saying? You can say you're a Christian all day long, but actually living the teachings of Jesus Christ, well, that's a very different thing. And what we understand is not everybody who says he is a Christian or she is a Christian is actually putting Christianity into practice. Now, if you were to look at the Crusades, what you understand is those are people who are claiming to be Christians, but they're not following the teachings of Christ. Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were of this world, my people would fight." Now, let's go for the implication of that statement. If it were of this world, my people would fight. It's not of this world. Now, what's not stated but implied, since it's not of this world, that means my people don't fight. The Crusades were a use of the word Christian that is not in line with the teachings of Jesus Christ, along with the Salem witch trials and various other things that would be thrown underneath the heading of Christianity. Now, let's then ask this question. Are there some people who are unbelievers that are very moral in some ways? Absolutely positive. In fact, there are some people who are atheists, but if you were to say, hey, what do you think about lying? They would say, no, I don't think you should ever lie. What do you think about stealing? No, I don't steal. So what you need to understand we're not doing here. Here's what we're not doing. We're not saying this is the life of a person who calls himself a Christian. This is the life of a person who is an unbelieving atheist. And these two are going to tell us what happens with the implication of Christianity or atheism. That's not what we're doing. What we're doing is, if you don't believe that there is a God, what are the implications of that if you put it into practice? And if you do believe in Jesus and Christianity, if you were to put his teachings into practice, what would happen? Now, those are two totally different statements as to how they relate to what really happens in the real world. So, what I'm asking tonight is not, are there some individual atheists who are moral in a lot of ways? And not, are there some individual people who call themselves Christians who are very immoral in a lot of ways? It's not what we're asking. What we're asking is, the philosophy of atheism, if you don't believe there's a God, what does that lead to? Well, what you're going to see is everybody who has thought through this knows exactly where it leads. Now, if you would have asked me, Kyle, before you started at Apologetic Express, what were the moral implications of atheism according to what you have read, I would say, what? I don't know. I don't have any idea. I hadn't really thought through it. I hadn't really studied it. I don't know what the moral implications of atheism are. But what we're going to do is let the atheists themselves explain to you what they know about unbelief. Okay? Now, this is a Darwin Day address by a man named William Provine. William Provine was a PhD professor from Cornell University. And every year in February, universities all over the country have Darwin Day, where they celebrate the idea of Darwinism and Charles Darwin. And he was invited to give a speech on Darwin Day in 1998. And here's what he said. Naturalistic evolution has clear consequences that Charles Darwin understood perfectly. Number one, he said, no gods worth having exist. Number two, he said, there's no life after death. If you believe in Darwinism and naturalistic evolution, you can't say there's life after death. Number three, there's no ultimate foundation for ethics. Number four, no ultimate meaning in life. And number five, human free will is non-existent. Now, we could have a series of lessons on each one of those. But the one that we're going to focus on this evening is the idea that there is no foundation for ethics. Now, here's what we're saying. If you believe that there's no God, and that humans are here by random chance processes over multiplied millions of years, then who gets to say what's right or wrong? In fact, maybe a better statement would be, how can you say what's right or wrong? There's no possible way that you can have a foundation for any type of ethical statement, hey, this is morally wrong, this is morally right, if you're a product of blind chance random processes over millions of years, and so is the person next to you, and your opinion is just as good as everybody else's. And so, the idea, now, understand, this is not Kyle Butt making this statement. I'm just trying to clarify the statement that's being made. This is William Provine, who is he's the late William Provine now, but was one of the leading spokespeople for atheism. He's telling you, look, if you believe in atheism, you can't really say anything's morally right or wrong. We just don't have a foundation for that. Well, let's see what happens when you hear Charles Darwin make a similar statement. A man who has no assured and ever-present belief in the existence of a personal God or a future existence with retribution and reward can have, for his rule of life, as far as I can see, only to follow those impulses and instincts which are strongest or which seem the best to him. All right, let's say, according to Charles Darwin, William Provine, you don't believe that there's a God, you don't believe there's any heaven, you don't believe there's any hell, then how do you make your decisions about what's morally right or wrong? According to Charles Darwin. I mean, whatever feels right. Whatever instincts seem the strongest or seem like they're the best to you. And so you go down to the local steak joint. You order a 16-ounce T-bone. You get something that looks like about an 8-ounce sirloin. The person next to you gets what looks like your 16-ounce T-bone. You walk over to the next table and you say, hey, that's my T-bone. He says, no, it's not. It was put right here in front of me. This is what I ordered. You said, no, that's mine. I want it. He says, no, you eat the one you've got. I'm eating it. You punch him in the face. You take it because that's how you felt at the time. Is there anything wrong with that? Well, yeah, there's tons of stuff wrong with that. We all recognize there's stuff wrong with that. But Charles Darwin said, if you don't believe in heaven or hell, you don't believe in God, then really you just follow your instincts. Whichever one seemed the strongest, you go with those. Okay, are you starting to see why liberal didn't work? Because if you don't believe in God, and you listen to Charles Darwin, and he says the best you can do is follow your instincts. Well, if your instinct is to have 5 wives, okay. If your instinct is to kill your neighbor and bury him in your backyard and take his property and hope nobody finds out, all right. If your instinct is to lie in business and try to cheat your neighbor so that you can have a nicer house than everybody else, it's great. That's what Charles Darwin says. Now, there again, here's what I want you to understand. This is not Kyle Butt. I'm not making this up. I'm not telling you what the implications of Darwinism and atheism are. Who's telling you that? Charles Darwin and the atheists themselves. So you can't argue with the source where this is coming from. Now continue with me. Dan Barker, in his debate with Peter Payne, I debated Dan Barker in 2009, found this in my research for preparation for that debate. And Dan Barker says there are no actions. I want you to listen close, and I want you to listen, to work through before I get to it, the implications of this statement. There are no actions in and of themselves that are always absolutely right or wrong. It depends on the context. You cannot name an action that is always absolutely right or wrong. I can think of an exception in every case. All right, now let that sink in. He says, look, according to my atheistic Darwinism, you can't tell me that actions of any sort are always absolutely right or wrong. Now, in 2005, a student came up to the microphone during the question and answer session and said, okay, you made this statement, Dan Barker. What about raping a person? Would that ever be right? Now, here's what he said. He said, well, you know, there are some situations that will be so outlandish, it's almost like they would never happen. But here's what he said. If aliens came down and said, so what he said in the debate with Peter Payne, aliens come down, and they say we're going to kill all of humanity unless you do that to a person, then yes, it would be right to do that. That's what he said in 2005. Okay, now, here's what I thought naively in 2009 when I was debating him. I thought, do you know, if I can get one of the leading atheists to admit that they think it's morally right to commit this type of heinous crime, surely, the people who associate with atheism will back away from the belief when they see what it really is. So, in 2009, I said, Dan, you remember the student came up in 2005 and asked this question. I said, what about 2 people? I said, could you do it to 2 people? He said, yes. I said, what about 2,000? He said, yes. I said, what about 2 million? Now, you know where he's going with that. Where he's going with that is, ultimately, you could do it to any number of people as long as it would keep everybody else alive because his value is physical human life. Now, the audience was made up about 550 people and about 450 of them were members of the church. And when he said you could do that to 2 million people, there was a collective gasp in the auditorium and nobody could believe that he actually said it. You were thinking maybe he would hem-haw around and say something like, yeah, but there's... No, he just straight out said it. So he looks at the audience and he looks at me and realizes we're not in agreement with him at all. And he says, that would be the moral thing to do and you would thank me because you'd still be alive. So what did he say? Now, I responded to him, no, I would not thank you. Because even when I die, I've got a better place to go than here. And you see, that's atheism's Achilles heel. There's no better place to go. So whatever else in the world you're going to devalue, well, you have to do it in order to say that physical human life is the most important. But what we're going to see is that they don't really even think that physical human life is the most important, and I'm going to show you that. So just to put some what I would call academic statement on that idea, Randy Thornhill, Craig T. Palmer, Natural History, evolutionary theory applies to rape as it does to any other area of human affairs on both logical and evidentiary grounds. There's no legitimate scientific reason not to apply evolutionary or ultimate hypothesis to that. Now, I don't like even showing that on the screen necessarily. But here's what I want you to understand. Right now in the United States of America, there are 22 million people who claim not to believe in any kind of God. And lots of them will get on television like Dan Barker, and they will smile at you, and they will write an article titled Your Friendly Neighborhood Atheist, and they will explain that atheism does not pose a threat to society at all. In fact, there are lots of atheists who are much more moral than people who call themselves Christians, and they will try to explain to you that this is not a harmful belief system. And they are as wrong can be. That is a lie. The moral implications of atheism are so morally devastating that the psalmist could say, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable things. There is none who does good, no, not one. That's the implications of unbelief. And so you need to understand it. It's not, hey, we're just dealing with an academic idea that, you know, if some people become atheists, well, they can just become atheists. It's no big deal. No, you're dealing with something that is morally and, if put into practice, physically very, very destructive. And as they continue, Thornhill, in an article, in a lecture delivered at Simon Fraser University, he said, it's evolutionary, it's biological, and it's natural. Our male ancestors became ancestors because they conditionally practiced this. Now, there again, this man's not a Christian. He is an atheistic evolutionist who says, and now notice what he's trying to do. He says, we'd like to separate ourselves from this. We'd like not to be able to say, but you got to apply evolution to it just like you do everything else. And when you do, guess what? It's a natural implication of the idea that, hey, really, humans are just, in fact, they wouldn't even say glorified animals. They would just say animals. And so if you're just a little bit higher animal than the animal down from you, then guess what? The morals that are good for the bonobos and the apes and the lions and the tigers, well, they're good for you too. Because really, atheism can't give you a moral foundation for ethics in the first place. Continue with me. The idea of abortion. Where could you get the idea that it would be morally okay to kill an unborn, completely innocent human being? Could you get that from the Bible? You couldn't. In fact, were you to do any type of serious study on the Bible's position on unborn children, here's what you would find. That God, in the entire 66 books of the Bible, from Genesis to Revelation, recognizes a human life starts at conception and discusses and talks about that human life, giving that human life personhood from the moment of conception. And that if you were to compare the words that are used to describe an unborn child and a child that is born, what you would find is the words that describe John the Baptizer in his mother's womb is the exact same word that is used to describe Jesus after he is born. A child is a child whether or not that child is born or whether or not that child is one day after conception, and that's how the Bible sees it and states it very clearly. And if you were then to say, what does the Bible say about killing innocent humans? What you would find in Proverbs 6 is that the Bible over and over and over makes statements similar to the one found in Proverbs 6, that the Lord hates hands that shed innocent blood. And one of the reasons that he cast the Canaanites out of the promised land was because they were sacrificing their children, making them pass through the fire to Molech, literally burning them alive. And so the idea that you could go to the Bible and ever get some type of concept that it would be all right to kill an unborn child, you couldn't do that. And here's the simple reason for that. Because from conception, every person is made in the image and the likeness of God. You see, that's what God says in Genesis chapter 9. After the flood, God talks to Noah and he says, all right, now, post-flood, you can eat all of the animals. You can kill and eat the animals, but any person who kills another person, another innocent person, that person deserves to die because humans are made in the image and likeness of God. Now, let me ask you a question. If you don't think humans are made in the image of likeness and image and likeness of God, what happens to your concept of humanity? Now, the founders understood it perfectly. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. Among those are the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, once you get the creator out of the way, the endower of inalienable rights, what happens to human rights? Well, if you're not created in the image and the likeness of God, then why save a human over a very valuable German Shepherd dog that can sniff drugs out and the human... Well, We'll see what the atheist community has to say about that as well. Barbara Burke writes in Infanticide Science magazine, among some animal species, infant killing appears to be a natural practice. Could it be natural for humans too? A trait inherited from our primate ancestors. Charles Darwin noted in The Sin of Man that infanticide has been probably the most important of all checks on population growth throughout most of human history. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay, oh, hold on. Do you understand what Barbara Burke is saying? That's probably a better way to state that. She says, okay, if humans are animals, and what she's saying when she says, and we know they are, then would it be okay for animals to kill their babies? Animals do it all the time. My parents had a coon dog that was named Queen, had a pedigree as long as a truck, was a very high-powered dog. In fact, thought that the puppies from this dog were going to be worth about $1,000 a piece years and years ago, probably 15 years ago. She had 12 puppies, the first litter, and they thought, this is going to be great. She killed them all but one. Next litter, she had 8 puppies, killed all of those but one. For some reason, she thought she could only raise one puppy at a time. Now, Barbara Burke says, we look at animals, we see how they do things. Do you know what 10% of the adult Komodo dragon's diet is? Baby Komodo dragons. That's why baby Komodo dragons can climb trees and adults cannot, because if they could not, all the Komodo dragon population would be gone right now because they are cannibalistic and they eat the babies. If you've ever done any type of pig farming, you understand that you had probably better, if you have a litter of pigs, move those away from the boar, because there's a good chance that boar is not going to be happy with them. Now, Barbara Burke says, okay, we watch animals, this is how they behave. Guess what? If you're just an animal, and according to Darwinistic atheism, you are, well, would it be all right to kill your babies if you don't think you got the resources, or you don't have the time, or whatever? What's she saying? Yeah, be nothing morally wrong with that. Continue with me. Peter Singer, now let me tell you something about Peter Singer. Try to concentrate on me, don't read that if you don't mind. That's hard. Sometimes I have a little thing that'll black out the screen, and that's a little better. But Peter Singer is recognized as the leading ethicist in the world. Richard Dawkins, in a video with Peter Singer on YouTube, said to Peter, he said, Peter, I believe you are the most moral individual that I know. Okay, this guy, ethicist, is supposed to be the kind of person who will be able to tell the difference between right and wrong. This guy is supposed to be able to say, oh, you're struggling with the decision about this in your life. Well, think through this, and here would be the right thing to do. Here would be the wrong thing to do. Now, he's an atheist. And here's what he says about this idea of killing babies. He says, you know, if we compare a severely defective human infant with a non-human animal, a dog or a pig, for example, we'll often find the non-human to have superior capacities. Only the fact that the defective infant is a member of the species Homo sapiens leads it to be treated differently from the dog or pig. Species membership alone, however, is not morally relevant. Now, let's translate that into our normal. Hey, why do you keep a human alive instead of a dog or pig? Because it is a human. He said, but just because it's a member of a certain species of animal, that doesn't mean you should keep it alive. Species membership is not morally relevant. Okay, now remember, we hold these truths to be self-evident. All men are created equal and are endowed by their creator with rights to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. If you get rid of their creator, then they become another animal. And what gives a child rights? Well, it's going to be smart. It's going to be beneficial to society. It's going to be able to run fast. Well, what if it's not going to be smart? What if it's going to be a drain on the resources of society? What if it's not going to be able to run fast? In fact, what if the child was not ever going to be able to walk? What if the child is not ever going to have an IQ above, just pick a number? Then what do you do with it? Well, Peter Singer is going to tell you exactly what you do with it according to the atheistic ethical system that he is promoting here. He says, if we could put aside the obsolete and erroneous notion of the sanctity of all human life, we'd start to look at human life as it really is. He said, we've been keeping humans alive because somehow some people in the past have said there's some divine something about humanity, like they're created in the image and likeness of God, and we've been keeping humans alive because of that. He says, but I'll tell you what, if we really want to start looking at stuff like it really is, get rid of that idea and just start looking at them like they're just another animal. And then you'll be able to make a real ethical decision. You're starting to see how morally depraved this idea is. Well, let's see what he says. He says that a fetus is known to be disabled is widely accepted as ground for abortion. Now, let me stop right there and explain to you what he's saying. The people to whom he is writing, his fellow atheists and unbelievers and people that would say he has any right to be an ethicist at all, they would all agree with that. Notice the statement they would agree with. That a fetus is known to be disabled is widely accepted as ground for abortion. Now, would any faithful Christian accept that statement? No. Not at all. But what he's saying is, okay, what everybody knows here is if we look inside of a mother and we find out that that child is going to have some type of disability, we all say, well, yeah, you could abort that child. But now notice what he says. Yet in discussing abortion, we say that birth does not mark a morally significant dividing line. Now stop right there. Isn't that what Christians have always said? Birth does not mark a morally significant dividing line. Yeah. Okay, great. We're making some progress here. Okay, this guy says, hey, a day after the kid is born, he's no different than a day before. Is that what he's saying? Yeah, birth doesn't mark a morally significant dividing line. All right, a day after he's born, he's a child, she's a child, just exactly like the day before. Okay, so where are we thinking he's going with this? So if he's a child a day after he's born, just like he's a child a day before, which is what Christians have always been saying, great, so you can't kill him a day before, or a week before, or a month before, or 2 months before. Oh, no. That's not what he's saying. Now, you know where he's going. Not that you can't kill him or her a week before, or a month before, or 2 months before, but if everybody, according to him, recognized that you could kill him a month before, and birth doesn't mark a morally dividing line, then what? You can kill them a month after they're born, just as long as you don't, as a society, call them people yet. Well, don't take my word for it. If disabled newborn infants were not regarded as having the right to life until, say, a week or month after birth, it would allow parents in consultation with their doctors to choose on the basis of far greater knowledge of the infant's condition than is possible before birth. Okay, we all, his group, would say, yeah, you can abort a child if you find that it's going to be disabled a month before it's born. And he's saying, if you could do it a month before it's born, ethically, consistently, you should then be able to do it a month after it's born. And he then says, nevertheless, the main point's clear. Killing a disabled infant's not morally equivalent to killing a person. Very often, it's not wrong at all. Now, let me tell you what I thought. I thought, if you showed people that this is what the leading ethicist in the world says, then they would be so appalled at the implications of unbelief that they would say, no, I've got to find something else. And some, few, have. I'll give you an example. There was a young lady by the name of Leah Labresco. And she was writing for a blog site called The Atheistic Portal. And she had been writing adamantly against Christianity and religion and the idea of God for years and years. And then she came on the blog one day and said, this will be my last blog for Atheistic Portal because I have now become a believer in God. And she said, here is why. Because there are some things I know exist that atheists and atheism cannot explain. She said, I know there is moral, absolute right and absolute wrong. She said, and I've asked my atheistic friends and colleagues, where would that come from if there's no God? And she said, no answer has been given to me yet that's satisfactory. She said, here's what I know. We are like archaeologists uncovering absolute morality. We are not like architects building our own. There is a standard out there that says this is right. And we're not creating it and making it up and designing it as we go. We are finding it. And when we find it, that's it. Now, what you're finding is the nature of God. And as you uncover how the nature of God answers questions, you are then seeing absolute morality. And that's what she came to understand. So, yes, the moral question is what turns some unbelievers into believers. In fact, I'll give you another example. Maybe if you have read C.S. Lewis's work. C.S. Lewis was an atheist for many years, and in one of his works, Mere Christianity, he says, I had this idea that there was some type of justice in the world. And he said, that was my biggest problem with the world. It looked like an innocent child over here was suffering, and that was just unjust. Somebody had stolen some money from me, and that was just unjust. Somebody had done something wrong to one of my friends, and that was unjust. He said, but then I started asking, where did I get the idea of injustice? How did I know that what happened there was wrong? He said, I had two options. I could give up my idea of justice and wrongness, and I could say, well, I don't like it, but that's just what happens in the universe. Or I could keep my idea that there is justice in the world, but if there is justice in the world, there has to be a standard. And atheism can't give you a standard, so I've got to go somewhere else to find one. And he said, incidentally, atheism turns out to be too simple. You can't get a standard of morality from unbelief. It is not possible. Now, if you kept up at all, and maybe you didn't at all, but in 1976, Thomas B. Warren debated a guy by the name of Anthony Flew in Denton, Texas. Some of you might be familiar with that debate. In fact, several congregations where I go, one or two of the people there at the congregation actually were at the debate. There were about 5,000 people every night there in Denton, Texas. And Thomas B. Warren argued for this idea using the Nuremberg trials. Robert Jackson was the prosecuting attorney for several of the Nazis who had murdered and ruthlessly and brutally killed so many Jews and Gypsies and Poles, etc. And here's what the Germans' case was. It wasn't illegal in Germany. We weren't breaking any laws. You guys don't have a right to judge us. Because in Germany, our law was, you can do this to people because these people are subhuman. And we have the right to call whoever we want human, like Peter Singer is saying. And you from the United States of America or from the Allied powers, you can't tell us how to run our country. We didn't do anything wrong because we followed our law. What do you say to that? Well, Robert Jackson said, there is a higher law that crosses all geographic boundaries, all regional boundaries, and all country borders. Where do you get a higher law that crosses all geographic boundaries and all regional boundaries and all country borders? Where would that come from? You understand where it can't come from. You can't get something like that from the atheistic idea. The only place, according to these people themselves, that you get an idea like that is if there is a belief in God, a belief in eternal reward and punishment. Otherwise, well, you just follow the instincts and impulses that seem best to you. And when the Nazi generals sit in those chairs being prosecuted, they could just say, hey, if Darwinism is true, then I just follow the instinct that was strongest in my life, and you can't say it was wrong. And they'd be right if atheism were true. But it's not, and everybody understands that there is a higher law that you could appeal to and use to call those people guilty. So, I'm running out of time here, and I've got probably a little while to go, but let me finish with this. In 2006, there was a scientist who won Scientist of the Year in Texas. His name was Dr. Eric Pianca. Dr. Pianca stood up to receive his award in an auditorium that had about 400 of the most prestigious and educated and well-known scientists in the state of Texas at the time. Dr. Pianca is a reptile researcher. And here's what he stood up and said for his acceptance speech of Scientist of the Year 2006, Texas. He said, humans are no better than bacteria. Humans are getting in the way of the progress of the other organisms on our planet. And so we need to eliminate 90% of them. They ask him, what would you propose? And he said, something like airborne Ebola virus. It can kill somebody in 2 or 3 days, but it doesn't have any lasting effect on the environment. And so probably if we had something like airborne Ebola virus that would kill 90% of the human population, that'd be a great thing. This is 2006 Scientist of the Year in Texas. Now, what would you hope would happen to the reaction to that kind of speech would be? I mean, you would hope people be walking out. You would hope that there would be people who were just appalled at the statement of the implication that you should kill 90% of the human population so you could keep some animals alive. Okay, no, they gave him a standing ovation. And the students who were listening understood exactly what he was saying. Dr. Pianca's talk at the TAS meeting was mostly of the problems humans are causing as we rapidly proliferate around the globe. He's a radical thinker, that one. I mean, he's basically advocating for the death of all but 10% of the current population. And at the risk of sounding just as radical, I think he's right. 2006 Scientist of the Year stands up and says humans are no better than bacteria. You know why he can say that? Because for the last 60 years, the established teaching on the campuses of universities across our country has been materialistic Darwinism. And the implication of materialistic Darwinism is if there's no God that endows humans with the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, then why are humans any better than anything else? Well, they're not better than anything else. And so if they start taking over and wiping out habitats and killing or causing extinction of certain organisms, we need to stop the human proliferation. Do you see why this is so serious? Do you see why beliefs have consequences? Do you see why Jesus Christ said, by their fruits you will know them? A good tree doesn't bear bad fruit, and a bad tree doesn't bear good fruit. Everyone is known by their fruits. The fruits of Christianity are sweet. If you were to apply Christianity and the teachings of Jesus Christ to society, it would be a place to live. If you were to take the idea of atheistic Darwinism and put it into practice, the Old Testament writer gave you a commentary on that. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They have done abominable things. There is none who does good. No, not one. Let's make sure that when people look at our lives, they don't see somebody who calls himself or herself a Christian. They see somebody who behaves in the nature of, along with the teachings of, in accordance with the spirit of Jesus Christ. Sure appreciate your kind time and attention this evening.